Welcome to this episode of City Talks. My guest today is Paul Cheshire, Emeritus Professor at London School of Economics and co-author, along with Max Nathan and Henry Overman, of the book Urban Economics and Urban Policy, Challenging Conventional Policy Wisdom. We're going to start and talk about all of this in the book, and it covers lots of areas around urban economics and the theory and the evidence and obviously how that's played out in policy. But one of the first points you make in the book, which I think is quite interesting, is that when we're thinking about cities, and obviously we've been thinking of cities for a long time, you said really that urban economics has largely been ignored, but is now experiencing a sort of resurgence, or people are coming back to it. So start off by giving us a sense as to why you think urban economics has been ignored, given it's been around for a long time, Alfred Marshall and others. And then why you think we've seen this resurgence and what you think the implications are going to be. So why was it ignored?
I think it was ignored for two reasons. One is that actually agglomeration economies became less important because of the rise of manufacturing industry, in which they are less important, and big internal economies, plant sizes, etc. So, you know, Marshall was writing at the end of the 19th century, sort of at the end of an era. But land became increasingly unimportant in economists' minds. I think Paul Samuelson was the great sort of author of the mid-20th century, and I was brought up on his introductory textbook.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'd had land, labour and capital. But if you were an economist being trained 10 years ago, you'd have been told there are three factors of production: land, labour and capital, and we'll forget about land.
Right.
So since then, you know, land has increased in importance. And, you know, Thomas Piketty makes this point, in fact, about how much of total asset values are now locked up in land, and that is primarily, but not only, as I'll explain in a moment, because of the increasing importance of agglomeration economies. So that's one reason. Mm. The other reason, I think, is the way that the intellectual nature of economics developed after the Second World War, when you got sort of the revolution in microeconomics and the sort of neoclassical synthesis, as it was called, where there was a very strong assumption of constant returns to scale. So you had a whole very elaborate, very rigorous in terms of logic, sort of model worked out, where you had constant returns to scale. Like, cities can't exist unless there are increasing returns to scale. So economists sort of thought, we can't deal with cities. And really, I think that the key moment was when Paul Krugman wrote his famous article in 1991, where he brought together sort of economic models of the market and competition with allowing for increasing returns to scale and agglomeration. And since then, that really sort of linked back, because there were, of course, urban economists in the 1960s, 1970s, one myself in the 1970s. But it was difficult to talk to our colleagues in mainstream economics because we didn't have a common sort of intellectual framework within which we could communicate.
Yeah.
Now that has really changed in the last 15 years, I think.
And what have been the factors that have continued to allow urban economics to become more connected to mainstream economics, I suppose, what are the factors that have brought these two things together?
Well, I think that it was the original sort of offer that Krugman provided us with. Well, it wasn't just Krugman, obviously there was Fugitive and there was Jack Tietz and there were others, Tony Venables, working almost simultaneously, and they in fact all came together at various times to collaborate. But they produced an intellectual framework that allowed you to sort of reconcile the intellectual analytical equipment of mainstream economics with cities and the critical importance in cities of agglomeration economies and increasing returns to scale.
Yeah.
So since then, you know, we had a lot of applied work that, you know, people realised how important cities were, which I had always realised, but in a sort of rather applied, practical, pragmatic, empirical way.
Yeah.
People were able to sort of intellectually satisfy themselves. And the other thing is that, you know, again, going back to Thomas Piketty, we don't have to quote him, but there are others who've made this point, you know, land and cities have become more important because of the increasing role of agglomeration economy. So, you know, I was talking in the mid-1990s about urban resurgence and what might underlie that, because you've already noticed by 1990 that the patterns of decentralisation and urban decline were changing, and that was primarily based on the importance of agglomeration economies in those sectors of economic activity which were growing compared to their relative unimportance in large-scale manufacturing.
Yeah, no, quite. And just pick up this other point that you make in regards to urban economics and its relevant position in thinking about cities. You make an interesting point that some of the pioneers or some of the thinkers that are often associated with cities historically were engineers, or they were architects, or they were in the built environment. And you make this sort of suggestion that we often think about, therefore, as cities as being buildings or made up of buildings and infrastructure and such. And you make quite a compelling argument that's been made by, not least by Ed Glaser in his work, that actually our cities are really collections of people. But just expand on that a little bit more around, you know, where we are and that sort of thinking, and the balance between the hard and the buildings and people, why that really matters.
Well, I think we say in the book, you know, our view is that buildings, infrastructure, are not an end in themselves. Mm. We're not worried about maximising the welfare of buildings.
Yeah.
We're maximising the welfare of people.
Yeah.
So there are means to an end, which is to make cities be more productive and more enjoyable places to live, to increase the benefits of cities. Now, historically, in the 19th century, take your hats off to engineers, they absolutely transformed the nature of cities by applying the medical knowledge about the transmission of disease.
Yeah.
We got clean water and we got sewage. That meant that cities could grow. So
yeah,
it was a huge contribution, if you like, to urban growth. It was the sort of policy that we advocate in our book. That is, it was a policy which reduced the cost of urban size.
Yeah.
So, you know, rightly, people thought that there were physical solutions to many social problems. So, you know, the problem of the slum and rickets in the slums and lack of daylight and dampness, etc., you would solve by building better houses.
Yeah.
Now, up to a point, but only up to a point, because cities are about people and about economic activity, about social activity, about social interactions, and how you get the best out of them. And the other thing is, you know, looking at it with my cynical economist's hat on, who makes their living out of selling their services in cities? It's architects, designers, etc. There's a whole business of self-promotion in urban design and building buildings, because that's where the money is.
Yeah.
And whereas urban economics is a bit of a, it's an academic pursuit of a relative minority group.
Yeah. And, you know, following on from that, the resurgence of urban economics as a way to think about why cities exist, why cities, some cities are successful and why some cities are not, and then what we might do about that. You pick up, you say there are, you know, clearly three themes run through the book itself. One is around, we need to be more realistic and appreciate the powerful nature of market forces, you know, and the sense, the degree to which we're going against or with the grain on some of those things. And an outcome of that is how we accept or engage with the notion of unevenness, in the sense economic activity is not equally distributed across space or place. The second theme I think you pick up is this general point about the ineffectiveness of urban policy, or at least the way we traditionally think about urban policy, and indeed some of the unintended outcomes or consequences of some urban policy. And then the third theme, you say, when we do think about cities, we really ought to be thinking about how we improve the standard of living and the life potential of people more than place. So three things, just take each one in turn. So the realism about market forces, unevenness. Let's start there. Just unpack that a little bit. What do you mean by that? And why is that an important theme that runs through the book that really we should be mindful of when we're thinking about our cities and how they work?
Urban policy has been very much dominated by sort of physical ways of viewing the world. You know, to take, for example, our planning system, it operates not on the basis of demand for housing, on satisfying that, but on the basis of numbers of households. So it's counting people rather than estimating demand.
Yeah.
Now, as a planner, a very wise planner, I think, said to me only last week, you know, it's planners assuming that the market isn't there is rather like aeronautical engineers designing airplanes and assuming that gravity isn't there. Markets are working away under the surface all the time.
Yeah.
And if you intervene in one place, like pushing a balloon, you intervene in one place, you generate incentives, and as you've understood that process, those incentives may end up achieving almost exactly the opposite, or exactly the opposite of what you're doing, or simply wasting resources because you're trying to push water uphill.
Yeah, but just unpick this idea around, you know, we need to be realistic, therefore, about market forces, how we respond, and we need to be more accepting or appreciative of the unevenness of the economy and where it happens or not. Because one of the criticisms of, you know, agglomeration thinking and agglomeration economics is that it produces a spiky economy. An uneven economy, as some would say. We see some stuff happening in some place more than others. And people have this sort of feeling that that is somehow wrong, but you don't think it's wrong, and
absolutely,
you're completely comfortable with it.
Wonderful. So absolutely wonderful.
Tell us why that is.
You know, 14,000 years ago, we had a smooth world in which you had hunter-gatherers dotted all over the surface evenly, and then they began to come up with the idea of cities.
Yeah.
The whole nature of a city is it allows specialisation, specialisation in occupation, specialisation in activities, and it's hugely productive to allow that specialisation. But that specialisation, facilitating or exploiting that specialisation, necessarily creates unevenness. But I don't want to go back to a hunter-gatherer society. You know, cities are the most wonderful things that human beings have ever come up with, in my view. They hugely improve not only our productivity and our prosperity, but they hugely improve the quality of our lives. My favourite quote from the Communist Manifesto is that the great achievement of the bourgeoisie was to rescue the mass of the people from the idiocy of rural life. That's what cities do. They allow you to get away from these sort of closed, small, hierarchical communities in the countryside or traditional feudal society, and make your own choices. Mm. And your own choices involve your activities, a much wider range of things to buy, and a choice of neighbours. So one of the things about living in the countryside is you have no choice who your neighbours are. They're just the people who live within a mile or 5 kilometres or whatever it may be. I remember having this explained to me by a very elderly man in Wales, explaining why he had no choice about who he married. But he could only marry people within walking distance. You know, so cities release us from this.
Yeah.
And one of the great things about cities is the benefits and the pleasure you get from interacting with your neighbours, and from the fact that when you get neighbourhoods that have specialised people in them, you know, they tend to cater for particular tastes. So there you are, you've got the things that you want on your doorstep.
Yeah.
Now, of course, as an economist, you have to also realise that this is conditioned by your income. People who are poor have less choice about what they consume in every dimension, including they can't buy into the nicest neighbourhoods because they haven't got the money.
Yeah.
So the problem goes from the quality of the neighbourhood, so to speak, you know, it's not the quality of the neighbourhood in that people live in that determines how well off they are. It's how well off they are that determines what quality of neighbourhood they're able to afford to buy, live in. So that's one thing. So that leads also to unevenness. So I'm worried about societal inequality. Very concerned about that.
Yeah.
I think it's gotten worse and we desperately need effective policies to tackle it. But I'm not worried about the spatial manifestation of that inequality.
So some would be, though. They would say they go hand in hand, wouldn't they? They would say an unbalanced economy like the UK, which they would describe as being hugely dominated by London and, hugely dominated by London and its environs and its hinterland, and societal inequality, they are somehow linked. And if only we had a more balanced economy where London wasn't so dominant, that our society at large would also be more equal. What's your sort of sense on that?
I think one needs to differentiate between two different types of spatial inequality.
Yeah.
The one is the inequality within cities. You know, where do you find the poorest neighbourhoods in Britain? You find them in London.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you find the richest neighbourhoods in Britain? You find them in London.
Mm.
London is a very rich city. It's a very uneven city. It's got huge inequality within it. Therefore, we have huge inequality across the neighbourhoods of London. I would like to reduce that and reduce it effectively. But you also have inequalities which are across distant spaces, between disconnected cities, if you will, or only imperfectly connected cities. Yeah. Now, that those are what I would think of as potentially things that you need to address. So if you know, if you're born in, where shall we say, Blackpool, your life chances are not as good as if you're born in Canning Town or obviously Kensington. Mm-hmm. Because you simply don't have access in the job market to the sorts of opportunities, and even in the education market, to the sorts of opportunities that a big city like London offers.
Yeah.
But, and that's because of where you live. So that is, I would regard as a sort of a spatial inequality that is perfectly sensible to try to address through policy. Mm-hmm. But it's only a small dimension of spatial of the inequality across space, because the other thing, of course, is you get sorting. So the characteristics of people who live in London are very favourable to having high incomes.
Yeah.
You've got a very high concentration of university graduates in London.
Yeah.
You've got a very productive set of people in London.
Yeah.
But you also, of course, because London is so big, got the advantages of agglomeration economies. Just everything else the same, because London is bigger, its people here are more productive.
Yeah.
So the evidence, and this is one of the contributions, I think, of urban economic research over the last 20 years or so, the evidence is pretty clear, and it's quite rigorous evidence, it's not just my opinion, that doubling the size of a city increases the productivity of people by round about 5%. Mm. Everything else holds the same.
Yeah.
That's in a developed country like Britain or Spain, for example.
Yeah.
In underdeveloped countries, there's work, for example, done for India, which suggests that figure may be as big as 20%.
Yeah.
Double the size of an Indian city, and you increase productivity by about 20%.
Yeah.
So cities are simply more productive because of these agglomeration economies.
And just, you talked a lot about the benefits of agglomeration and the benefits of the scale element of agglomeration. Pick up, just talk to us a little bit about, clearly we see costs associated with agglomeration, whether it's pollution, whether it's congestion, whether it's crime, you know, whatever those sorts of issues are. And give us a sense of how those costs and those benefits play out with each other. If, you know, if we're increasing the size of a city, do they run broadly, you know, linear and parallel to each other, or is this a different dynamic, different relationship going on?
Yeah, so I just said that, you know, I think the best sort of central estimate, of course, this error, is that roughly speaking, in a country like Britain, you double the size of the city and you increase productivity, everything else equal, by about 5%.
Yeah.
That's still setting aside from the consumption advantages of cities, agglomeration economy. But of course you have these costs, you're right. I mean, in the 19th century, 18th century, 17th century, you had huge costs because once the city got above about 50,000 people, they were drinking their own excrement, and that, you know, caused very serious health problems. So one of the, as I said earlier, contributions of drainage and clear water is it allowed cities to get much bigger. And that's a very important lesson to us. Our policies, to have sensible urban policies, they should be focused on precisely those costs that come with bigger cities. And they're therefore facilitating cities to grow and increase welfare.
Yeah.
Now, those costs, as you said, you know, congestion and pollution, two obvious ones, but the most important one is increasing costs of space.
Yes.
As cities get bigger and they get more productive, people compete for space within them, so the price of space goes up. Now, we've only just very recently begun to get what I would think of as serious urban economic research on what that precise relationship is, right, estimating that relationship. And there's very interesting work from France. And what they've come up with in a pretty rigorous way, and they've actually approached it from three different directions, and it all gives roughly the same answer, is that if you assume that the land supply of a city is fixed, then costs rise roughly at about the same rate as agglomeration benefits rise in production. If, on the other hand, the land supply is elastic,
yeah,
then they only rise at 2/5 of the rate,
right,
at which the agglomeration benefits rise. So the very obvious lesson from that is we need to plan and facilitate cities to grow and extend.
And this picks up on one of the issues that you've, you know, you've focused on, I think, throughout your career, but also very recently, which is about the consequences, predominantly negative, of the constraints that the planning system in the UK provides in terms of land supply. Just tell us a little, you know, what's your sense as to what are the problems that the planning system is introducing?
Well, you know, the very obvious lesson from what we have learned about urban economies is that we should facilitate their growth, which requires that we plan for their growth.
Yeah.
Because you can't, you have to have a long-term plan, not just a five-year land supply, but an infinite land supply. That is, you need to have a pattern, a way of rolling out your city over time that at least is without a horizon. Of course, you may one day decide that there should be a horizon. And we don't do that. So what we actually do in this country is exactly the opposite. We constrain our growth. We have growth boundaries. We have green belts. We have containment, whatever you want to call it. But we don't just have containment outwards. Green belt, London is sort of hemmed in by this huge green belt. But it's also upwards. I've got a lovely map of London showing where you can't build above seven stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost all of central London.
Right.
I mean, central London, you know, out beyond Hoole of Islington, for example.
Yeah.
You know, out sort of the inner ILA area.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, either there are site corridors to St Paul's or to the Tower of London, or there's conservation areas where you can't build up. Historic buildings you can't change if they're listed buildings. Now, that's not that it's unreasonable to have those constraints. There are benefits associated with them.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very pleased that we have historic Paris and we can't, you know, overwhelm it with 40-storey skyscrapers. I'm very pleased that we've got parts of London that are historic areas, that are conservation zones. But we should be thinking about the costs that that's imposing as well as the benefits it's generating. We don't try to quantify the benefits and the costs of those.
And so how would in terms of that, I mean, one of the criticisms is, well, we have the Greenbelt, otherwise London would sprawl into Milton Keynes or into Oxford or, you know, into the home counties, and that just would further increase commuting and land use acquired. I mean, what's your response to that? And I suppose partly, would the country be better off if we did expand London?
The country would be better off, people would be better off. And not only people in London, but people who presently can't afford to be in London that would benefit from being able to move here.
Yeah.
Now, you know, put yourself back to, just to do a thought experiment.
Yeah.
Push yourself back to, say, 1750. Here we are in London. You know, my word, we must have a greenbelt stopping Mayfair expanding Kensington. You know,
yeah.
Think how much more beneficial it would be if London had some nice muddy fields separating Kensington and Mayfair.
Yeah.
Instead, it's got wonderful things, which is Hyde Park.
Yeah.
We need our urban parks.
Yeah.
But the Greenbelt isn't that. The Greenbelt is, the only purpose of the Greenbelt is to stop anything happening. And it covers an area, particularly London's Greenbelt, it covers an area about five and a bit times the size of London.
Yeah.
Even within the GLA area, we've got 32,500 hectares of Greenbelt, about over 20% of the surface of London is Greenbelt.
Yeah.
Now, I just do not see that there's a societal gain from stopping, you know, Barnet sort of extending up to the M25 or maintaining a division between Southall and Slough.
Yeah.
Why is the world a better place? So we now put in, you know, we're putting £18 billion on Crossrail, but we can't develop any houses because a lot of it's going to be served in Greenbelt. For instance, Iver, which is going to be served by Crossrail.
Yeah.
It's going to be transformed, so it's only going to be about 35 minutes from central London. Can't build any houses there. Can't build any houses in Taplow or Maidenhead. This is, you know, it's almost criminal insanity.
Yeah.
Because the Greenbelt, where we've got environmentally valuable land, which we have, you know, there's plenty of environmental, high-quality land in the Greenbelt, areas of outstanding natural beauty, sites of special scientific interest, country parks, Windsor Great Park, etc. Of course you want to preserve them. Of course they're great environmental, public, social assets. You need to preserve them. But most of the Greenbelt's not like that at all. It's privately owned, intensively farmed farmland.
Yeah. Yeah, no, quite. The issue about land supply, land constraints, clearly a significant issue. Your work, some of our work, you know, highlighted the pressures in and around London, pressures in and around places like Oxford and Bristol, successful, predominantly, not exclusively, but successful southern cities, that where the economy is most buoyant. Give us a sense as to how land constraint or land supply, we should be thinking about that. If we're thinking about Manchester or we're thinking about Birmingham, does it apply equally there? How does it play out in economies where pressure on land is slightly different? Shouldn't we be equally concerned about these sorts of issues or not?
Well, as I was saying earlier on, the market is always working there under the surface, and it throws up useful signals. And one of the signals it throws up is prices. Mm. So everything else equal, we should be building houses where people want to live and where they're most productive. How do we know where that is? It's where the price of land exceeds the price of land in other uses. Mm. Now, of course, sometimes we wouldn't want to allow that because we want to preserve that area of land, like heritage coastal sites or National Trust land. There's lots of land we don't want to build on because it's got high environmental value.
Yeah.
However, where, take Barnet, if you could get permission to build on a bit of agricultural land in Barnet, the value would presently go from about £20,000 a hectare to about £7 to £10 million a hectare. This is ludicrous price distortion. It's a really serious price distortion. In a sense, that's telling you it's a signal of foregone agglomeration economies.
Yeah.
We could be using that land far more productively if we built on it or allowed building on it. And the other thing is, you don't need very much of that land. So in the allocation of land, in everything that this economy, our economy works on, it takes account of price signals. Of course, there's market failures. We need to not just slavishly obey price signals. We need to interpret them and understand them and, if necessary, regulate the market. But we do need to pay attention to them. And what the land market and the housing market is telling us is that we are simply not building the right sort of houses in the right places, and we haven't been doing that for about 50 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true in Manchester. It's less true in Manchester, but it is true in Manchester. Yeah. It's true in Newcastle. I just saw some work from the University of Sheffield showing the commuting patterns from the 2011 census, for example, spatial commuting patterns. If you look where people who work in the GLA area now live now, they're coming from 3 hours away, some of them. So you can see this huge sort of cobweb covering most of England, really. And that's London's commutership. But it's also interesting if you look at Manchester or Birmingham or Newcastle, particularly Newcastle, which is not a terribly big town. Mm. That's also got this is bound around by a green belt. And it would benefit from releasing more land.
Yeah. One other response, it'd be interesting your point from an urban economics perspective on, part of the response to land pressures or growth pressures in London is that if we constrain or limit growth in London, we can push economic activity to other places, whether it's Birmingham or Manchester. And you get this argument in a Manchester sense, increasingly people saying, the problem of growth of Manchester is that it's happening in the city centre, in and around Trafford and Salford and Manchester, and Oldham and Rochdale or Burnley and Blackpool that are slightly further away are not able to respond. And what we need to do is to push economic activity into these places. What's the what's the urban economics response to that desire or aspiration?
Well, I think that sort of policy, which we've actually practiced through our planning system for the last 30, 40 years, is not just a second-order policy. It's about a 120-second-order policy. It's a really seriously inefficient way of trying to sort of change the spatial structure of the economy.
Yeah.
Because I've done some work, for example, on the effects of town centre first policy on the productivity of retailing.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise, retailers are better able to judge the most productive places to put their shops than planners are.
Yeah.
So we ended up, I think, a reasonably rigorous estimate that the town centre first policies since 1993 have reduced total factor productivity in retailing by 32%. Now that is a really large number, and that comes from forcing retailers to be in places that aren't as productive and on sites. So it's not just a question of the general location,
yeah.
It's the particular location and particularly the access to that location.
And how does that affect consumers? I mean, how does that affect the, you know, the person on the street? Why are they, why is that, why are they worse off as a result of that?
Why would you be worse off if the British economy was 32% less productive? You'd be 32% less well off. Yeah, yeah. It's okay. It's only the retail sector. The retail sector is only 5% of the British economy, but it's not a small sector.
No.
So this is increasing the costs of retail activity. It's making it less effective and less efficient. You're more likely to go to a store and find it hasn't got what you're looking for, mm-hmm. or it's got the wrong size, mm-hmm. or whatever, because it simply is more difficult to organise the supply chain, given what we've done to it.
Yeah.
And the same is true. You know, if you've got an urban area, one of the great things about urban areas is that their housing markets and their labour markets all at the same time. There's constant adjustment because there's a lot of commuting. People can change where they live and work all the time. Mm. Particularly, they can change where they work. So if you put jobs into a borough of London, for example, I remember doing an evaluation of the Harlesden City Challenge. Mm. It was quite a successful city challenge revitalisation effort. It actually was associated with an increase in local unemployment over the 5 years it ran, but it did help increase the number of jobs, and it also produced some very good training, basic training for unskilled workers. Why did it have no local effects? Because the jobs weren't taken by local people, and the local people who improved their place, their labour market skills, you know, disappeared from Harlesden as quickly as they could, because it's not a very nice place. It wasn't a very nice place to live.
Yeah.
And if you improve your job and you earn in power, then you change where you live, and they were replaced by people who had even fewer labour market skills.
Yeah.
So you can't. It doesn't matter. I mean, I can't categorically tell you that Oldham is part of Manchester.
No.
But there's so much interlinkage across the Greater Manchester area that really it's much more a question of sorting and neighbourhood differences within a city than differences across the city.
Yeah.
And
that would get to that theme, the third theme really, or in the book, which is, and that's a perfect example, I think, where even when we're thinking about, you know, cities and urban policy, which we often think about it in a spatial sense, we should be really caring about outcomes for people rather than place. And in the sense that, you know, if people of Oldham get a job or get training and skills that allow them to acquire a job and they move to somewhere else, or if we build a house in London and somebody from Hull moves to London to take opportunities that are in London and not in Hull, that's an entirely appropriate and a very good outcome from your point of view. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our planning and housing policy are, if you like, sort of nailing the feet of the people who live in Hull to the floor. They can't move because they can't afford to move because we've created such huge price differentials in housing costs. So it's, once you're locked into a housing system in a particular location, if it's a declining economy, we've constructed a world in which it's very difficult to take advantage of opportunities elsewhere.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, if the sorts of policies that we're advocating there were actually applied, you'd have much smaller regional house price differentials. So it'd be much easier for people to move from one region to another. And because, I mean, at the moment it may be that Hull is relatively unsuccessful as a local economy, or it might be that Sunderland is, but that's not necessarily going to be the case forever. We need to have an urban system which is adaptable and flexible and can facilitate change, not attempt to sort of King Canute-like resist it. And that's what we need, and that's what's going to actually benefit people. So the idea that you can improve people's lot by, for example, forcing them to live in mixed communities, or stopping growth in London because it's going magically to go to Sunderland or Hull or Hartlepool or wherever, it won't happen. It's just as likely not to happen at all, or simply go some country that's a bit more accommodating.
This is an interesting point around, you know, one of the criticisms, I suppose, of the agglomeration argument is, you know, it's got nothing to say to places like Hull or to Sunderland. It's essentially it's only got something to say to those places that have relatively strong economies or potentially strong economies. But, you know, I think you just answered, in a sense, later, that isn't the case, is it? It's about thinking about the interplay between costs and benefits on the
and allowing for flexibility and dynamism and adaptation.
Yeah.
The world doesn't stand still.
Yeah.
The early 20th century, first half of the 20th century, Norwich was one of the poorest cities in Britain. It's now one of the more successful and attractive cities in Britain.
Yeah.
Inverness was one of the slowest growing cities in Britain in the 19th century. It's actually been one of the fastest growing cities in the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, no, very good. I want to turn a little bit to give some thoughts on one of the areas in the book that you explore. And we've talked a little bit around urban policy, and particularly the ineffectiveness of some of the urban policy attempts that we've tried, whether particularly small area-based type initiatives. Give us a sense as to what your take is on that. And then I think we're close with, take this resurgence of urban economics and the thinking behind it. Translate that, what would that mean in a policy context? What would we be doing and thinking about policy? You've outlined a few of them already, but just to bring those back to the fore as well. So first off, just talk a little bit around the ineffectiveness of urban policy a lot of urban policy that we've...
It goes back further than that, Andrew. See, I'm even older than you. So my first job as a researcher was working on a study of the framework of regional economics in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And we laid it away. There was a National Institute and Department of Economic Affairs, long before your day.
Yeah.
We laid it away. Our conclusion was that basically regional policy, as it then was called, had diverted resources. So one of the things... 1950s, we had this policy of industrial development certificates. Mm. Industrial development certificates meant that for any factory of more than 10,000 square feet, you needed to get a particular permit. So what did you get? You got lots and lots of factories of 9,990 square feet, and you got lots of factories that are more than 10,000 square feet just across the boundary where the policy ran out, so to speak.
Yeah.
My colleague Henry Overman has just been recently doing some work on the LEGI scheme.
Yep.
What does he find? He finds essentially the same issue, that the primary result of the policy is it increases activity in the zone that's benefiting, but it almost 100% offset by the loss of activity in the zones very close to that boundary.
Yeah.
So it simply displaces activity from one place to another. Now, it may displace the activity, but it doesn't mean to say that it makes the people who live there any better off, because again, as I said with the Hartle City Challenge example, the jobs are not, in the absence of some organisation like the KGB, where you can send people to the gulags if they take jobs other than the ones they're supposed to take, people are able to choose where they work, and they're able to choose where they live, and I'm very pleased to hear it, because I think that improves their welfare.
Yeah.
But you cannot, therefore, by forcing jobs to go into a particular location, improve the job prospects of the people who live in that location, because the jobs may not be taken by people who live in that location.
Yeah.
Because an urban area, and that's one of its huge advantages, one of the sources of agglomeration economies, is one interactive labour market. So one of the most important determinants of where firms employing very highly skilled labour in London, where they locate, is actually the public transport system.
Yeah.
So Bank Station or Oxford Street Station, if you're in the media industry, are the two key hubs, because it allows you to draw on a 12 million population.
Population, yeah, quite. And the resurgence of urban economics as a way of understanding cities, how would you want that to be then translated into how policymakers think differently, or what they do differently than what they've currently done? What can urban economics tell us about the things that we should be thinking about and trying to introduce?
Well, I think we said earlier that cities are more productive and they're better places to live, other things equal, the bigger they are.
But
they
do. Is that true in the UK as well as it is elsewhere? Well, because some people say, look at the international evidence, and the relationship between city size and productivity is strong, I think, in the US, and others would say, but in a British context, we don't see such a clear a clear observation between those two variables. What's your sense on that?
My sense is that we do in Britain see highly significant, but the policy does its very best to prevent it.
Right. Very good. Nice response.
So it does, is it? You know, as I said earlier, in India and China, we seem to find even bigger, stronger yes. relationships.
Yep.
So that tells us that what we should be doing is constructing policies to offset for the costs that increase with city size.
Mm-hmm.
As I said earlier, one of the most important of those is space costs.
Yeah.
And what our present policies do is that they not just aggravate, but they aggravate by orders of magnitude the increase in space costs as cities get bigger and more prosperous. Because the other thing that we continuously forget is that what drives the demand for space is actually incomes, much more than it is number of people. It's why all this nonsense or unpleasant debate about immigration in the context of Brexit is, and then they put it in the context of the housing market, is so irrelevant, because immigrants actually consume less housing than long-term residents. And if you look at the data, if you look at the research, I've done this research,
yes.
In determining the demand for housing, incomes, real incomes, are far more important than the number of households. Really, orders of magnitude more important.
Yeah.
Unless we want an economy that's completely stagnant and where people don't get better over time, then we've got to supply more space. Now, I don't think that's a bad thing, because there's lots and lots and lots of space. Houses only occupy about 5% of the area of not just houses, all the things associated with housing only occupy about 5% of the surface of England.
Yeah.
About 95% of the surface of the southeast of England is green, in some sense or other. There's lots of space out there. There's 500, the Green Belt of London stretches from the North Sea to Aylesbury.
Yeah.
It's not a small area, and you only need a very small fraction of the environmentally useless or even negatively valued land within that, which has access, like, for example, given access by Crossrail 1, which is going to open up vast tracts of land, potentially. Yeah. To accommodate that growth and people's demand for housing. So that's the very first thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should be more relaxed on building upwards as well. And one of the criticisms of London is it has this strange sort of scattered squat towers. But that isn't because... That's because we don't allow people to go up over most of London.
Yeah.
We should have a more relaxed policy on that. But the other items, the issues that we've come up with, which I think are important, are pollution, congestion, and I would add to that crime.
Mm.
All those are things that increase as cities get bigger and get worse. So, in the 19th century, pollution was a problem of essentially excrement in the water supply.
Mm-hmm.
It then became atmospheric pollution from smoky fires, I'm old enough to remember the last great smog in London.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see them anymore. Why? Because we took a sensible policy, which was to introduce smokeless zones.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be really serious about combating pollution in the atmosphere, particularly from vehicles, but not only from vehicles. It's a technically solvable problem. We just have to have the resolve, and not much in the way of resources, but the resolve to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
We can solve it. And we also need to invest in good quality mass transit, which is the complement. We also, and economists have been urging this on policymakers since 1964, we need to have congestion pricing.
Yes.
And I was associated with the Eddington report, and that was our primary recommendation. And it was in the public domain for 6 weeks. But we need to have the courage to actually introduce congestion charging. And that would greatly, you can never get rid of congestion in a successful city.
No.
Because that's that's a result of it being successful, but you can make it much less of a problem. And then the final one, I think, is crime. As Ed Glaser pointed out, there are agglomeration economies in crime. If I'm close enough to give you an idea, I'm close enough to give you a disease. Pick your pocket.
Pick your pocket. Quite.
So, we do need to take crime seriously in cities because it's a problem, but also because, of course, it counters the success of cities. And cities with higher crime rates do economically worse.
Yeah. And your final thoughts on whether the resurgence of urban economics gives a sense as to where the field of urban economics is. How healthy is it as a, you know, as a vibrant academic and intellectual field? And how confident are you that more of the concepts and the ideas of urban economics will find their way into the policymaking field? So just how, you know, are we confident about urban economics? Is it a good space and place to be in?
Yeah, I've been in urban economics for all my working life, yes. More or less, or spatial economics, we say, and it's in a better place than it's been at any time since I got into it, so to speak. So I'm very pleased, if you like. You know, we've got a really strong cadre of PhD students at LSE, but other places as well. And the other thing is, I'm a bit of a sort of, sort of fundamentalist. As I explained, the reality is that land and cities are becoming more important.
Yeah.
You know, if we look at the difference in agglomeration economies between sectors, and this is work by Dan Graham at Imperial, which suggests, you know, in business services, media, and in public administration, government.
Indeed.
Agglomeration economies are about three times as important as they are in manufacturing.
Yeah.
Which are the growing sectors of our economies? Exactly those sectors.
Yeah.
So cities are becoming more important, whether we like it or not, and economists follow the money. You know, they will be paying more attention to cities because they are clearly, we've made the case that cities are really important for the success of our economies and for welfare, for happiness, if you like. So I think urban economics is in a reasonably good place, but I think it'll get better.
And do you think that'll translate into the policymaking community as well? Can we be confident in that?
Well, two things there. Policymaking community, as you know, all practical men are the slaves of dead philosophers. So it takes 20 years for new research to get into the world of practice, because people learn it as students, but they don't learn it when they're actually engaged in the world of practice, because they don't have time, and anyway, they've gone, and, you know. So that's one problem. It's going to take a generation to seep through, I think.
Mm.
And the other thing, of course, is that there are clearly political issues involved. You know, I've skated over all the issues, the political issues associated with the Green Belt and our housing problem, because one of the very sad consequences of our policy has been that it's created huge asset values in property and housing. Mm-hmm. So people defend their asset values. And, you know, that's, so we've got a sort of, we're between the rock and a hard place. On the one hand, we can't not reform our planning system. But on the other hand, we've got a political constituency who are going to oppose a reform very, very strongly, and have done. You know, we saw the huge hullabaloo there was when that very mild revision was proposed for the National Planning Policy Framework in 2012.
Yes.
Created havoc. You know, a strange combination of the reactionary right and the reactionary left.
Yes.
No. Barber jackets and sort of levellers out together on the same side. But, you know, you need to think it through. It's not a question of what the intention of a policy is, in my judgment, it's a question of what the outcome of the policy is.
Fantastic. My guest today has been Paul Cheshire. Paul, thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Very good to talk to you, Andy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.